It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent RodHunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
Good evening, and this is not Bob Siegel. This is Mike Friedenberg, and I am very honored to be filling in for Bob this evening. I come on here as a guest pretty regularly, but occasionally Bob needs a fill-in host, and Bob is off with his beautiful wife, Dana, visiting family. So I'm very happy to be here. And of course, just a little background, I write regularly for Responsible Statecraft, Epoch Times, have a lot of stuff published in National Review. But one of my biggest claims to fame is being friends with Bob for a little over 40 years. And another major claim to fame is being friends with my guest today, Barry Jantz, for close to 40 years. And Barry is the former CEO of Grossmont Healthcare District. He runs Jantz Communications, was the chief of staff for J. Edler Suris Assemblyman, many years involvement in politics, sits on the Economic Development Commission, East County Economic Development Commission. So very, very active in the community, and he's one of the great connectors in San Diego. Knows a ton of people, knows state and local politics, federal politics, but the reason I was very excited to get him on is he really is very connected with local politics. So Barry, welcome, and thanks, what Mike. Do you want to talk about today?
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Yeah, I think you forgot I was on a city council in a city where you lived.
Well, and yes, Barry was on the city. How many years were you in the city council?
I was on the city council in La Mesa for 16 years. But 16. My claim to fame is Mike Friedenberg, right here sitting with me, was my appointment to the Human Relations Commission. That sounds like a really good commission, doesn't it?
It was great, and I fought off all the weird stuff they were trying to do for you, Barry.
Yeah, so you're a good guy there. So last night I was at an event, as you, I think you know, because your wife was at my table.
Yes.
It was a Sharp Grossmont Hospital event, but the mayor, Marco Rapostathos, was sitting at our table, and I mentioned, hey, Michaeline, who's Mike here's husband, is married to Mike Friedenberg, and he kind of looks and he goes, I recognize that name. Well, you were on the Human Relations Commission when he was first on the city council, I think.
I believe so, yeah. Yes. That he's been there a long time now.
Yeah. So, hey, local government, right? Housing. You want to talk about housing?
I do, because that's why I brought you on, because it's amazing. A lot of people are really maybe up to date on national politics, maybe somewhat up on state politics, but not as many people are up to date on local politics, surprisingly.
I think a lot of listeners here probably know it's very tough to get new homes built in San Diego County. Probably a lot of places, California especially, but particularly in San Diego, it is very difficult. And you asked me the other day, well, why do you think that is? So we can talk a little bit about that if you want. But it's been I was reminding myself of this study that Point Loma Nazarene, the Fermanian Business and Economic Institute put out like 10 years ago. And you might think, okay, that report's dated. But when I talk about the report, I think the listeners are going to recognize not a lot has changed in 10 years. So when this report came out in 2015, they dug into what was standing in the way of getting housing, and of course, new housing leads to more housing affordability. I think we can probably all agree on that. What was standing in the way? And at that time, in a nutshell, it was that regulatory costs and delays, those two things alone, add about 40% to the cost of building new housing.
When the report came out.
This was 2015. Okay. So obviously there's other things involved in that, but just regulatory costs, meaning government, was standing in the way, and delays. And they determined that the average cost of a new home time to get a new home development from concept to actually starting to get it out of the ground was something like 8 to 10 years. So even if someone's got a great concept and they can get through the government regulatory agencies with all their entitlements and everything else, if it's going to take that long, by the time they start building it, the costs have gone up so much that whatever their original costs were have been thrown by the wayside. So delays as well. And so I think we can probably say that in the 10 years since then, there hasn't been a lot of change. There's cities are doing more ADUs, accessory dwelling units, what we used to call granny shacks. I hope that's politically correct to say granny shacks.
Yes.
But they're doing more of that. But not a lot has changed. The state government has even had some legislation in the last couple of years to try to mandate that local government does more. And I'm not sure the answer is ever at the national or state level to do a one size fits all forced thing at the local level. But we're still stuck here 10 years later with housing costs to the roof, no housing affordability, and a lot of people that are on the cusp of being able to be in the housing market just are not there because of what we're talking about, costs. They're on the cusp, but because regulation and fees are putting another $40,000 to $50,000 to $100,000 to $150,000 on the cost of the home, it's pricing a lot of people right out of the market. And government, by the way, Mark, government's answer to this is, well, let's do it ourselves. Let's build housing for those who can't afford housing. And we can talk about that if you want to. But
I had the honor to do some special projects for County Supervisor Joel Anderson for a year. So I did get a little bit versed on some of this stuff. And I'm going to say, based upon what I looked at there, that in the intervening time between this Fermanian Business Center report and now, things have gotten worse. In particular, one area that I do want to talk about is vehicle miles traveled, because I believe that was not included in that report.
Sure. So VMT, vehicle miles traveled, that was not really on anybody's radar at the time. I mean, this whole report about what cities can do to increase affordability, try to get rid of some of the regulations, that's been out there for 10 years, but they weren't talking about something. The report was really focused on the city of San Diego and seven or eight other cities in the region. I'm not sure how much it was focused on the county, but tied to this problem in San Diego County is the fact that in unincorporated areas that the county of San Diego has imposed through their general plan requirements, it makes it very difficult for any housing developer to be able to do anything. So therefore, if you can't build anything in what we call the backcountry or the rural backcountry or rural East County, rural North County, North Inland, if you can't really feasibly do anything there, it forces a lot of the builders to have to do it in the cities, where there's infill projects, there's not in much room to build. There's NIMBYism, there's a lot more of it. So, in concept, the general plan of the county of San Diego is about protecting the backcountry from, just run rampant development. Of course, there are some things we need to protect about our pristine areas, but there's so many thousands of acres of land that could be developed on. So if you're looking at trying to do something in the backcountry and you're saying, okay, if it's semi-rural, I can get away with a half-acre lot, that's potential. But further out, where it's mandated that you cannot do anything except a home on a 10-acre lot or a home on a 20-acre lot, or in some cases, one home on a 40-acre lot, no one's going to be able to
build. That's rich person housing.
That's rich. Right. So if you own a 20-acre lot and you're rich and you can afford to go through all these things we just talked about, regulation and delays and getting it approved and building it, well, you can afford that.
You can build your compound.
But no developer is going to do even quasi-affordable housing when they can only put a home on even a 5-acre lot. So that's a problem. And VMT, so you mentioned vehicle miles traveled. This is an additional condition that now is being looked at, that if you're going to build far from transportation hubs where you're going to have to drive a long way to get to work, then we're going to charge you more. And so that is called vehicle miles traveled. So that has even further priced home developers out of trying to do anything in the more rural areas.
Let's get specific on what that means per mile.
Yeah. So, well, this county of San Diego, you worked for the county of San Diego for a while. You worked for Supervisor Joel Anderson, right? Yeah. So, there was an estimate the county of San Diego did that showed it was a county commission study estimated vehicle miles traveled mandate could add between $10,000 to $19,000 to the price of a home. But let me get clear, per mile. So if you live 10 miles from a transportation hub, that's 10 to 19,000 miles. Each one of those miles, do the math, times 10.
Yeah.
And that, where does that put the price of a home? Again, for the rich person, they can afford it. But developers aren't going to build homes at that cost in an area where it's just prices not only them out of the market, but anybody who's going to be purchasing homes out of the market. Who does it fail? It fails those who are on the cusp of wanting to get into the housing market, not the folks that already have homes.
Let's step into the 50,000-foot level for a second here.
Sure.
Something that I learned, that all of these rules and regulations, redensification, you know, urban corridors, housing hubs, basically, they don't want you to build. They want you to build homes along these already established urban corridors. And then the goal there is, and the Sandags has a plan on this, super high-speed public transportation. They really want to get you out of your automobile. So if you're going to get you out of your automobile, they first have to, they can't let you go and expand out. They want you to be in a very dense area. That's the rationale there. I mean, it's crazy.
Well,
and
it
all comes down to global warming and climate change. That's been the impetus at the state level for these mandates, is to reduce use of the automobile and protect the climate from climate change.
And of course, and if anybody thinks, okay, well, if enough housing is built in the rural backcountry, then it warrants public transportation out there so people can get out of their cars, that it doesn't even begin to be feasible. Okay, so let's get into this report from 10 years ago. Again, nothing's changed, but I'm guessing that 40% increase in the cost of housing due to regulations and delays has become worse in 10 years. We don't have a study on it, but I can't see anything that suggests that things have gotten better. But that report came out with recommendations. You know, and so without getting into the things that would have to happen at the state or federal level, because that's going to be a problem, you know, changing CEQA, you know, doing CEQA reform, you know, getting state government on board. I mean, you know, just at the local level, there were recommendations about incentivizing more what they call 80-20 development. Well, you are doing 20% for housing affordability. If you're doing a home development, you're doing 20%, which is, a lot of people confuse low-income housing or low to moderate income housing with Section 8. That's not what it means. It means that it is priced no more than the median price of a home or rental unit in the area to be able to live there. So you know, that's maybe a good goal, but defer development fees until you get out of the ground. So developers don't have to pay the fees up front. Government's still going to get their fees, but it's when they start making money from purchasers of these homes, right? Reduce parking requirements, reduce commercial space requirements, you know, shorten entitlement processes, approve community plans with master EIRs. I mean, a lot of these things make sense. And, you know, so if anybody thinks, oh, this report came out 10 years ago from, you know, some folks that wanted to get more housing and it was ignored, you can pull this up just by looking for the name of it and find it all over the place. There was a lot of discussion about it from everyone, not only liberals, but conservatives. Everyone, the San Diego Chamber, Jerry Sanders was at the chamber by this time. He came out and said, we need to do more of this. Liberals were saying the same thing, San Diego Housing Commission. And so there was a lot of discussion about it as a good thing. We need to do this, but nothing's happened. I think all of these city councils and the county of San Diego should, on an annual basis, be asking themselves, how are we doing on this list of recommendations? and why are we not? Could we do three of them? Could we do two of them? Could we do a modified version of these things? That's what should be happening.
So, some of it's going to be cut off of what they can do because of what the state is doing. But My conclusion was, is literally, if you were trying to do everything you could to keep the cost of housing high, to not have housing, and to make sure that how whatever component of that contributes to homelessness, if you wanted to do all these things to make homelessness easier to achieve, they've done that through all their regulations. They've done that through VMT. By the way, they don't care about the VMT that's generated people from coming into their counties, which is hundreds of miles sometimes, you know, each week back and forth. They don't count that in the VMT requirements, as I recall there.
Yes, that's correct.
And then you have the SANDAG and the, you know, regional housing needs assessment. They've been doing these for decades, and they always put out these goals like, you know, housing units for above moderate income, housing units for moderate income, housing incomes for low income, and housing units for very low income. So, you know, sitting at, you know, for the last 30 years, it's been like 5% of the housing units for very low income that are built that they say they need. 7%, you know, for the low income. Even the moderate income is like, you know, what I'm looking at here, about be 8%. And then, you know, even for the above moderate income, they're only building like about half, maybe a little over half of the units. So it's ridiculous. This is pie in the sky. And SANDAG was talking about a super high speed public transportation system to induce people to get out of their cars. But even as they've been talking about it, the trend in California has been to lower and lower income people buying cars. I mean, so it's fantasy thinking. This stuff is fantasy thinking. Meanwhile, you know, the housing, we don't have housing. We have, if you build more supply, the prices come down.
If you build more supply, it there's, you know, actually developers are even incentivized through profit's not a bad thing here, to invest in more housing. They don't sit on their dollars, they invest in more
if
things
they can do it.
And more housing supply will lead to it's a simple supply and demand issue in which it will help on housing affordability. So, but when government says, okay, well, let's do housing first, let's do with the housing first concept, which is let's anybody who needs shelter, anybody who needs what, you know, even transitional housing, we're going to give them a permanent housing choice. And you look at the cost of government doing that versus the private sector, it's just priced to the roof. It's ridiculous.
Well, I sat in some discussions with the county, you know, trying to buy an apartment building, you know, and repurpose it for, you know, transitional or low-income housing, you know, $70, $80, $90 million. It was just huge amounts. We've seen the numbers out of L.A., just, you know, insane. You know, $300,000 to $400,000 per dwelling unit for a small apartment for it's just not doable. So you have this, and it really does go back to this mindset that they don't want us using our cars. And that's really, here in California, the green agenda has been pushing this. It's just really the underlying philosophy of it. And this vehicle miles traveled is getting pushback. It's getting pushback. Groups, minority groups, you know, groups around are actually saying that this is racist provisions because it is so driving up the cost of housing, is that ethnic minorities and minority groups cannot buy housing. And so they actually have come out against things like the vehicle miles traveled aspect there. And that's, you know, that's an interesting thing. But, you know, when we get back, let's, you know, we can finish off and talk about, you know, the wonders of ADUs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Up there on that, you know, just have, what a wonderful.
Granny shacks. Can we say granny shacks?
Yes. Granny shacks there. So look forward to that discussion here. And we'll be talking about that and also maybe talking a bit about, you know, get back to the national level, talk about the news that I guess the shutdown is over.
Yeah, I was listening at the top of the 5 o'clock hour to the Dave Stahl show,
which is amazing. There, yeah. You know, so that is good news. However, that's not the end of things, because I do think we need to talk about the end of the filibuster there. And when we get back, we'll definitely talk about that as well as the exciting topic of ADUs.
There we go.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480-539. W&S Electric.
Looking for a book you won't be able to put down? Push the Winds Around is a romance set in the context of science fiction. Dr. Brandon Krieger is given the opportunity of a lifetime, a psychologist's dream. Through the usage of his physics professor friend's time machine, Brandon travels 20 years back through time in an attempt to change one man's destiny. Tom Kyle, a convicted and unremorseful murderer, is located in the past when he was a six-year-old boy. Brandon's mission? To alter Tom Kyle's path and prevent him from being a vicious killer. Matters are complicated when Brandon finds himself falling in love with young Tom's mother. Push the Winds Around, a novel by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
This is Bob Siegel, here to tell you that sometimes in life, the obvious is obvious. When I debate my atheist friends in formal college lecture halls, they always talk out of both sides of their mouth without realizing it. I had one person start by telling me that he had a real problem with Christian morality, saying that there was such a thing as right and wrong. There was no such thing as right and wrong, he said. Another problem that he had with the Bible was that the Bible had this evil God who told the ancient Israelites to go out killing people. He said to me, "Why was God so evil in the Bible?" I said to him, "Why are you concerned about good and evil? You just made it clear a moment ago that there's no such thing as evil. In fact, you made that abundantly clear." But he did believe there was such a thing as good and evil. Now, the God of the Bible happens to be good, but the point was he caught himself in what we could call a Freudian slip. This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious.
Nothing like some good Phantom of the Opera to bring us
there
in.
There we go. There we go.
So we're back here. And as I promised, we're going to talk about the exciting world of accessory dwelling units. And Barry, take it away.
Well, okay. So this seems to be one of local government's answers that they have implemented. I think the state has pretty much insisted on it, and a lot of local governments are doing it. You know, the funny thing is, with accessory dwelling units, what we used to call granny shacks, and now it's accessory dwelling units. So it's a rental property for, on your property for anybody, and it's just caused. I'm not saying I'm opposed to it. I'm not, but it's caused so much of a nightmare in neighborhoods now, because a lot of folks just are saying, "Hey, there wasn't enough parking on my street to begin with." So now when you're putting an accessory dwelling unit in your yard and you had certain amount of parking off street, your garage or your driveway, and then you're going to rent to someone else who's going to be living here. All of a sudden, there's a need for more parking. Well, where is that parking going to be if you don't have what's called off-street parking, meaning at your home property, your driveway, your garage? Obviously, these ADUs go in, and there are no garages that typically go with them unless you've really got a sizable lot. And so it dumps these cars on the street. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so that's why ADUs, which in concept, it's a good thing. It's a more housing affordability. It increases the housing supply. It increases the rental housing, right? It helps with families who want to, you know, help with a family member. All of these things, except it's in the huge increase in the number of them, and some of them much larger than the houses the folks are in the to begin with, are really causing a concern. And that's why there's such a pushback in the communities now. And so, you know, this is a form of NIMBYism, not in my backyard. No, it's not in your backyard across the street. I don't want it because I don't have anywhere to park anymore, you know. So we're seeing this sort of thing. Well, the concept is, oh, you don't need as many cars, right? Like you said, the concept is people in ADUs are going to use public transportation, right? Okay, well, that's not reality. That is not reality. So it's just, you know, just to, without ADUs being a bad thing, it's creating more of a nightmare. And I think a lot of folks are going to be hearing way more news about that in future years, about communities and neighbors screaming at each other over ADUs.
So once again, when I look at this, I just see this fantastical fantasy thinking on people's parts that's not realistic. The idea of the high-speed corridor with the high-speed super transit. I mean, really, this is a sand-egg concept of, you know, these high-speed rails flying up and that it's going to excite everybody to get in their cars, you know, get out of their cars. It's not happening. In the meantime, you cannot build housing in the – I mean, what are the property values of lots? Well, it's a gradient. The closer you are to the ocean, the more expensive the lots are. And they actually, by the time you get, you know, 15, 20 miles inland, they maybe become affordable. And we can't build there. So right. It's fantasy thinking. The housing situation has not significantly changed. And these ADUs, you know, they're pushing them. But, you know, you buy into a neighborhood. Let's say you pay, gosh, nowadays, what's a cheap house? $700,000?
Yeah. Well, that's a cheap outhouse.
Don't make me feel bad, Barry. Okay, so $700,000 to $1 million for a house. And you bought the house and you've been there, and all of a sudden, you know, you paid for that house, for that area and that property, that value, and you paid for a certain environment. And all of a sudden, people start putting ADUs in. They are going to diminish your – it may or may not diminish your property value, because maybe the fact you can put an ADU in helps increase – I don't know. But the bottom line is your quality of life is being changed, and it's being pushed on you. So –
And you nailed it. You know, the closer you are to the ocean, obviously, beautiful views, ocean breeze, ocean. Just, you know, housing prices are going to be more. The further you get out, the more affordability potentially. Until you get to this kind of north south line, you know, which is kind of Ramona, east of Lakeside, you know, east of Jamul, and anything beyond that point, and forget it. You know, it's no longer semi-rural, now it's rural, and so you've got these massive lot sizes, which we talked about earlier.
Well, so. but that, right, and that's all based upon them trying to make it hard to really build housing.
That's correct.
And I think I really sometimes feel like they just want us to leave California, but they would like us. They want our tax revenue. I don't know
I believe even liberals want more housing. They want housing affordability. They want more housing. But you nailed it. If it's going to be far enough away that you know, folks are going to be in their cars because there's no public transportation, there's no ability to do that. That, you know, that's why in the rural backcountry it's almost impossible to build.
Yeah, and then you talked about this wonderful idea that, you know, every housing development project has to have 20% affordable housing, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that does boost the price up on all those other housing dwellings. The other housing dwellings, that boosts the price significantly, right?
Sure.
It's not free.
Yeah. Sometimes there's incentives, you know, that come. The local government can't afford those incentives. So, you know, there used to be, larger federal and state incentives. I mean, with federal and state budgets the way they are, I'm not sure that's reality anymore. But yeah, so yes. But the concept there is if a developer comes in and says, we're going to do the 80-20, so that for every 8 homes that are market price, we're going to do 20% at, you know, low to moderate income housing price. You know, that's an incentive for governments to give that developer to say, well, great, we're going to make it easier for you. But obviously, it decreases the ability for that developer to make money, and they've got to pass on the cost of the high-priced homes to those purchasers to make up for the loss on the lower price.
So
it's simple economics.
So regardless of all the good intentions, the bottom line is we haven't been adding supply to the housing market.
Absolutely not.
That's the bottom line. So let's just put a stick on that. I mean, it's what I call it is fantasy thinking, wishful thinking. It doesn't reflect reality, and sadly, and to make a generalization, a lot of times the liberal thinking, not even the left thing, just the plain old liberal thinking, maybe good intentions, but it just doesn't get you there. And then you have this overlay of, you know, the what I think is an overly concerned, being overly concerned about climate change, you know, driving a lot of these bad policies. But anyway, that's great. But thanks, Barry, for covering that, because I think it's absolutely nice to catch that. So we did hear about the shutdown being ended, and
so I heard about it. Brandon's here covering the covering the board, but I heard it on the Dave Saul show at the top of the hour, or else I wouldn't known. I wouldn't have known I was driving.
And I didn't
in
know
here,
until so you came in. So
it sounds like a Senate vote there.
At 5 o'clock, that's when they officially announced it, or at least the information was leaked by Fox News themselves.
Well, I think that's great news. My wife's flying tomorrow, so I want the maximum number of rested air traffic controllers, you know.
Have you seen how ridiculous some of these lines have been at the airport?
No.
I mean, they're going into the parking lot itself and they're zigzagging.
Oh, it looks
like almost a mile worth.
I've been in a one like that at Denver one time, and that was, but I can't imagine what it's like in Denver now. I don't even want to think about that.
I was going to say, I remember one time I was going to fly out to, oh my gosh, I can't remember now. Seattle, that's where it was. And we just so happened to pick the one day where that particular airline I was flying decided to have a strike that day. So all the workers stopped and all the flights got delayed by 4 hours at least. And I'm like, of course this happens to us.
Yeah, of course it does.
So. Yeah. But I was saying last hour that this situation, I hate using a term of this is just putting a Band-Aid on the whole thing, but this is where I will say putting a Band-Aid on this situation actually is approval by me, I will say. I like how we are going to be talking about the Obamacare situation in December. Now, what results will come about will vary, and we'll see what will happen from there, but at least we get through the main part of this whole situation, and that is ending the government shutdown. That's my main goal and main priority in getting through this.
And Mike, I got to tell you, if you're telling me your wife, Michaeline, is flying tomorrow, so you think the air traffic controllers are going to be right back on the job tomorrow? Maybe she should fly in a few days.
She doesn't have an option.
Okay, yeah.
She's got a very busy schedule, but I'm probably, that's fantasy thinking on my part.
I'm sure if you've been off work for a while, even if you're rested, and you get a call saying, hey, it's over, you need to come in tomorrow, you're kind of going, I'm calling in sick tomorrow. I'm not ready to go back.
I hope not as well. Listen, a 2-week shutdown, the country hardly even notices. But we had gotten to the point where the shutdown was actually beginning to cause some real damage. You know, it was damaging GDP. It was affecting the air traffic controllers. You know, and there's way too many on the SNAP program, obviously, but we can't solve it this way, the 40 million. You know, we can't just arbitrarily stop sending it to everybody. There's some people that really do need it.
And it was probably maybe eye-opening to conservatives. You know, when the government shuts down for a week or 2 weeks, like you say, you know, it's kind of like conservatives are, you know, kind of saying, hey, you know, it's a good thing. I feel safe in my home. But, I mean, when it gets beyond, I mean, that's where, the reality of government programs, like them or not, mm-hmm. starts to impact the economy and other things. So, clearly, you know, we needed to do something. So.
And I didn't want people's holiday travel to go back with their families to be impacted. That's mm-hmm. awful. That's horrible. I mean, you're going back to see people maybe once a year. And, you know, some of those people, I mean, I'm getting, you know, I'm a model here maybe, but some of those people may not be there next year, you know, when you get to fly. So, I mean, you really don't want that happening. So that's good news that it's
– I'm glad you mentioned SNAP, though, because obviously, you know, the fact that SNAP has been on everybody's radar, folks who didn't know what it was a few weeks ago.
Right.
You know, and they're hearing, well, yeah, what? What's the number? Brandon, you mentioned
40.
40 million people?
40 million.
40 million.
Yeah.
That's ludicrous. I'm right. sorry, but that is ludicrous.
No, it's true. And again, Dave brought up a good story about it, about how there was this woman who owned a Bentley, had a fur coat, still bought stuff with food stamps. So, and I know that one person isn't the only example. There's going to be millions of other examples out there that have been taking advantage of the system. And I'm hoping the federal government will look into this.
Well, sure. And what Dave said, you know, was, hey, he's fine, as am I. I'm fine with helping those who need help. But when there's no requirements to improve yourself, to find work, if you are capable of working,
able-bodied,
you know, that becomes a real problem.
I do. So. I agree there. So that gets us back, though, because there was building, you know, President Trump was started to add pressure to the filibuster. And, you know, maybe 15 or 20 years, or maybe even like maybe 10 years ago, 8 years ago, I mean, I saw the reason for the filibuster. You know, the idea was that, you know, if you're passing major legislation that's really going to have a profound effect in the country, you don't want to go 50% plus one. If you'd like to have more of a consensus. And that was the general idea behind, you know, the 60 vote cloture, and mm-hmm. or that it used to be 67 and they not lowered it to 60, but now, you know, 60 vote cloture is that you wouldn't get that situation. But things have changed, and, you know, during the Biden administration, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, you know, Democrats that were sort of moderate and more reasonable, they're the ones who stopped the Democrats from eliminating the filibuster. Mm-hmm. It would have been eliminated. And let me ask you, Barry, do you think there'd be any hesitation? Well, but you know what? You can answer when we come back. But would there be any hesitation? You can think about this deeply and long of the Democrats to get rid of the filibuster if they had the power to do that. And we'll get to Barry's answer right when we get back.
This is Bob Siegel. As a Christian apologist, I hear scorning and ridicule all the time from Bible skeptics and unbelievers. Some churches will still respond to such people with love and understanding. Others do not.
You Christians are such morons. There's no proof that God exists, and only a pea brain would believe in miracles. Wake up! Step into the 21st century. Besides, Christianity is responsible for most of the world's problems.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Relax, my friends. That's not the kind of response you'll get from Skyline Church. We welcome you just as you are, with all your doubts, all your questions, and all your concerns. Your problems with religion are understandable, and I promise at Skyline you'll experience the love of Jesus Christ, not the revenge of a Sith Lord.
Skyline Church. Not sure when to try an unusual novel? Let the customers speak for themselves. Here is another Amazon customer review for Bob Siegel's latest book, The Dangerous Christmas Ornament. While there is nothing in this book that would stop you from giving it to or reading it to your kids, this book will certainly hold an adult's interest as well. The Dangerous Christmas Ornament has it all. Magic, talking cats, bullies who get their comeuppance, fun dialogue, and a good story. Do not let the title fool you. While Christmas does play a prominent role, this is really not a Christmas story, and it can be read at any time of the year. The Dangerous Christmas Ornament, available on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
I'm Dr. David Poole, president of San Diego Christian College. At SDCC, you'll find a number of dynamic degree and certificate programs, including business, aviation, kinesiology, education, psychology, ministry, and more. Our curriculum blends academic excellence with a Christian worldview, ensuring you graduate ready to make a meaningful impact. Your journey starts here. Learn more at sdcc.edu. That's sdcc.edu. San Diego Christian College. Begin your journey.
Ah, we're back. So,
thankfully, we don't have to talk about ADUs anymore, right?
Right, no, we're done with the ADUs. No, I mean, remember, I left this question for Barry. Yeah. Barry, if the Democrats were to gain control of the U.S. Sure. Senate, they had the U.S. presidency and the House, how long would they delay before they got rid of the filibuster?
Only they'd delay as long as there was no filibuster. No, they would...
Okay, that's true. Yes,
no. You can get around the filibuster by changing the rules, right? And you don't need 60 votes to do it. You only need a majority to do it. So I think they would wait about a week, you know, until they could get the House rules changed.
I guess so, probably. Unless, for example, from the reason the Republicans were going on with everything they asked for, they would wait. Well, but your first answer, as long as the Republicans did what they wanted to do, they wouldn't get rid of the filibuster. As soon as they didn't do what they wanted, the filibuster would be gone in a nanosecond, really.
Right. Okay, but, you know, so I guess the real question is, do we need the filibuster anymore? Does it make sense?
Well, in this environment, it doesn't make sense. Because here's what I think about the filibuster for Republicans. For example, we now have the government reopened. And we've been talking about we want to reform Obamacare. Well... are we going to get any good health care package in place with getting another, what, 8 votes? We're going to need 8 votes from the Democrats to do that? No, we're not.
Of course not.
No, so there is no health care reform. Unless we get rid of the filibuster, there is no health care reform. Unless, I guess, we could fold it into another big, beautiful budget. I'm not sure that would work. But or we have 12 individual budget. That we're supposed to pass for, right? And they already have 2 or 3 mm-hmm. that have passed the House and were pending U.S. Senate approval. Are any of those going to be passed without a filibuster? Those, you know, they can filibuster those too. Sure. So we basically, the Republicans are saying that they don't want to where this is the proud and noble institution of the U.S. Senate. We're collegial people here. No, that is not the way it is anymore. If you watch these hearings, there's not a collegial environment anymore there. And the Democrats are going to they shut down all Trump's appointments. They finally had to do a mass thing there, and they're going to have to do that. So stop fooling around. Let's get some things passed.
If Republicans don't get rid of the filibuster out of nobleness, they're going to wake up to the fact that Democrats are going to do it anyway. You know, if the Democrats get to that point of having the power. So, you know, obviously. And I know, you know, at 5 o'clock, Dave and Brandon and, you know, we're talking about the, you know, what do people know about the filibuster? They, you know, it's Mr. Smith goes to Washington, right? The filibuster. I'm not sure the filibuster's ever been really noble. I mean, it's been a reason to do things, but they found, you know, the modern filibuster, you don't really listen to anybody talking. It goes to a silent filibuster, and they get other business done in the meantime. And then you've got, what, 30 hours until you can do something once the filibuster's off. But anyway, I just don't know if it makes sense anymore in a polarized environment like we have.
I totally agree. It does not make sense anymore. So what does make sense is for the Republicans to get rid of the filibuster, then to pass some things that actually will help the country. Improved health care,
you know, some reforms, get them through, and give them some time to start working. Because now the idea that the Democrats will never regain power, I know that there's some people out there saying that. I don't believe that. At some point in time, they're going to regain power. It could be as soon as 2028. We don't know now. Nobody knows. So let's get the stuff out there and make it working. So at least once the if the Democrats do assume power again, then you could point to a record and say you're going to be destroying something that works, as opposed to just sitting here for the next, you know, 3 years and getting very little done. I guess I said, now we did get the at one big reconciliation bill, then I guess we can do another one. But the Democrats will not if once it becomes to their advantage and they get in power, they will not stop to remove the filibuster. So we need to move forward and get things done. People expect that. They want things done. And that's one of the things that's the worst thing about Republicans is they get frightened. They sit up there, and we've seen it. We've had the majorities before, and they sit up there, and they're afraid to do anything because of what the New York Times. It just seems that way to me. Maybe it's less than that used to be, but they really –
I can point to years of Republicans having control and not doing, you know, when they had a mandate, not doing enough. In fact, that's what led to Donald Trump being acceptable to a lot of Republicans and a lot of other folks.
Yeah,
there was a time when Donald Trump wasn't acceptable to the mainstream Republican establishment and, you know, the Mitt Romneys of the world. I mean, it was actually pretty much a do-nothing Republican mentality that led to the Donald Trump being acceptable.
Well, don't do anything. We're here because we're here because we're here. I don't want to do anything to rock the boat because I want to maintain the majority. Yet by doing that, people got – I mean, the term feckless, the number of times I thought of the word feckless is appropriate for so many – many years of Republicanism, and then the Democrats get in there and they get the power and they go hog wild. They wield it ruthlessly,
oh, yeah.
And they don't give a hoot, and they get things done. I mean, you know, give them some credit.
If I could say one quick thing, this past Tuesday alone showed that there was a lot of Democratic sway all of a sudden, it seemed like, with a lot of the things that were passing, whether it be for Prop 50 or, say, some other things that were going around the country. The New York mayor situation, of course. The New Jersey, it was the governorship?
Yeah, the New Jersey governorship. Virginia, yep. They elected the
It seems like it's a tall tale sign or maybe I should say a foreboding sign for me that maybe the Democrats a strategy somehow, I don't even know how exactly, but somehow it's actually working and it's causing the American people to start thinking, maybe this way is not starting to work so well or something like that. But I'm hoping and praying that's not what the American people are thinking of right now. I hope this is just a little speed bump in the road and we get over it, hopefully. I mean, Prop 50 is going to be pretty hard to fight because, I mean, it is going through a court system right now, too. A bunch of state Republicans are suing and putting it through court right now as we speak. But, man, they got a really, really long, tall order ask.
Oh, it is. And I see, you know, on Prop 50, I mean, I don't know if we're talking about Prop 50, but obviously it just passed overwhelmingly. I haven't been surprised, you know, since day one. I thought from day one, just by the nature of the party registration in the state and the number of Democrats who were likely that even if they felt like, oh, I'd rather have an independent redistricting commission, they felt like they were doing the right thing to battle back against what they saw Trump doing in Texas or whatever, so they were going to vote for it.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised it passed, and it passed overwhelmingly. But I did see a lawsuit, you know, within the last few days that stands out as if you sue based on you know the Voting Rights Act and civil rights and coming down to one man, one vote concept, that maybe there's something there and that the lines were drawn in such a way that what the Supreme Court has said, lines need to be drawn to not disperse communities of interest. Well, that includes minority communities. So as soon as you're drawing lines that break up a minority community, that lessens the chance of a minority member of Congress, then that is in violation of federal law and the Supreme Court rulings in this regard. So we'll see. There's some hope that maybe there's a lawsuit that finds its way. we'll see. Yeah.
And to the higher issue, is this a foreshadowing of things to come in, you know, the midterms of 2028, what we just saw here? And it doesn't always, it's not necessarily a good prediction on these types of elections as to what's going to happen there. But on the other hand, you know, just sitting there thinking that, you know, I hear some Republican optimists saying, oh, it's all another Democrat will never be reelected. Well, we just saw a whole bunch of Democrats get elected. Mm-hmm. We saw them outperform the polls. We saw Republicans underperform the polls. Now, I think it's because, you know, listen, imagine you're a liberal or a left-wing Democrat, and you've been sitting since January seeing what's been happening with President Trump and the Republicans. Can you imagine how frustrating and angry you would be?
Absolutely.
I mean, this is a nightmare for them. So finally, you get a chance to get out and vote, and you do. You're going to get out and vote. This is the first concrete thing you get out and vote. And then the other thing that happened is, and this is something that some Republicans have been forgetting about, you know, when Trump ran in 2024, he pulled in tens of millions of votes that are people that do not vote for Republican. They voted for Trump. And these Republicans are thinking that these people are automatic Trump votes are not being realistic. And these people did not come out and vote in this last cycle. So that's something that we have to work on for the midterms. You know, Trump in 2018 I've never seen a president work harder during the midterms to try to not lose the House. He still lost the House. And it's very hard to beat that midterm trend, you know, right, that switching right. the other way. And he worked very hard, but he could. I still don't think he was able to get his voters to come out there. So that's what we've got to look at. We can't assume that it's
what I've always called, you know, the monarchist viewpoint that, you know, if you've got the top spot, that everything's okay. And if we're looking at... and you're right. It was the number of votes was reflective of not just Republicans who vote Republican and make sure they turn out and vote. It was reflective of a lot of other folks who came out and said, we want to support Donald Trump.
Low propensity.
Right.
Low propensity voters.
Right.
That you know, things that drive me batty about Donald Trump, they love. The fact that he does things that make me go, wow, what is he doing? They go, yeah, that means he's not a politician. And he really is not much of a – maybe he's a very good politician, but I guess in some ways he's so atypical that he appeals to people. I mean, for them, a J.D. Vance is a smooth-talking, slick politician.
Yep. Right.
And for Donald Trump is the opposite of that. He's not really a slick –
Yeah. Donald Trump turned the concept of what a successful politician is on its head because of the number of people who say, I just want someone who's – talk straight and gets things done, and you know, and a lot of them couldn't care less about Republican versus Democrat. It's just about they like him.
Oh, and he talked about their loss of jobs,
yeah,
and he got their vote, and he improved his vote in the working middle class among the, you know, communities of color. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a huge step forward, and I do think it's a huge mistake for Republicans to be counting on that vote in the midterms. And even to count on that vote in 2028, I think J.D. Vance is probably likely the candidate. I mean, he's the best bet for right now. And I think he's, you know, he's really good, but he's still not a Donald Trump. He's still, you know, yep. So anyway,
I still think he has the speaking power to really persuade people. And I think he does, while he's not as good of a negotiator as Trump for sure when it comes to certain foreign policies possibly, I'm not sure entirely on that whole situation, I still think he will do much better than, say, some other people who I cannot stand in the slightest.
Right.
Newsom, Harris, insert other names in there if you would like to, but I can't say.
I really like J.D. Vance, so mm-hmm. And I think that he's got 3 years to really cement his connection to that MAGA vote there. But anyway, Barry, I just really thank you for being here
this evening.
Thanks
for having me.
And you know, and once again, you know, to Bob out there, if you're listening, thanks for having me in to you know, host your show. And with that said, I believe that Bob will be back next week. So thank you for listening to the Bob Siegel Show. This is Mike Friedman for Bob Siegel with Barry Jantz.